I certainly enjoyed reading Cities on the Hill, and one of the things that struck me about it was the fact that you have examined these different cultures, also radically different. What, as you developed this book, was this your intention, or did the book stem from your analysis of these individual cultures, the gay culture in San Francisco, the Falwell culture, and so forth?
It didn't start with an idea, but rather with the experience of going into the Castro in 1978, and then 6 months later, walking into Jerry Falwell's church. And, of course, I'd heard of both of them before, but the experience is quite different. And I began to think we've always divided ourselves up in different ways as a nation. We tend to see ourselves in certain ways. In the 60s, we began to see ourselves in terms of race and gender and so on. And I began to think, goodness, probably the greatest cultural differences in this society are not between races or ethnic groups, but rather between within the white middle class. And I began to see that both of these were new cultures, something created during the 60s and 70s. And I began to look around for others and then to think about the process of social change in this country and to look back at the 19th century for parallels.
But there have always been these disparate cultures in our society, haven't there? But they don't seem to last. These cultures seem to be ephemeral, and then they...
Well, some of them last for quite a long time. When you consider that evangelical Protestantism began only in the 1840s, it has lasted a good long time. The Mormon Church was started in the 1830s. It certainly has lasted very well. Then there is a certain ephemera, of course, on the top, because in the 60s and 70s there were literally hundreds of new religions started, mostly by the young, and some of those have proved ephemeral.
What are the echoes of the cultures you write about in City on a Hill in the 19th century, or did you just mention them?
No, there are definite echoes, because they occur pretty much when the same kind of thing is going on in society. First, fairly radical economic change, followed by social change, by increase in mobility, both geographic and job-wise, by a kind of shaking up of the society. In both cases, in times of great prosperity, it seems that our roots in this country are not all that strong, because obviously the 60s. Came over Europe, too, with very different results. There are not too many new religions in Europe or new cultures formed out of it. Indeed, in Europe in that period, the strongest theme has been that of cultural reaction. When you think about the reemergence of Catholicism in Poland, the reemergence of the Basque and Catalans demanding cultural identity, the war in Northern Ireland, and so on. But in this country, we tend to create something new every time.
Now, there seems to be a more opposite, let's see, how can I phrase this? The Falwell culture, if you call it that, and the culture in the Castro, they seem to be kind of established cultures in a way. But the guru culture in Oregon seems to be kind of a phony one. It doesn't seem to quite correspond to the other two. Is that accurate?
Well, I picked the Rajneesh in Oregon because they represented a much larger group of people. That is to say, those who espouse New Age values, those who have been through the human potential movement in one sort or another. The Rajneesh, when they were going strong, seemed to wrap up all of the sort of youth culture into one. And the fact that that community self-destructed doesn't mean that these values do not continue to affect the larger society. So it was an example, and all of them are examples. Obviously, I could have picked another retirement community. There are many, but I would took one which was very coherent, very and quite isolated geographically. I mean, I think that by looking at something that is coherent, it's possible to see more about the society at large. I mean, in some sense, this book is a Middletown in the reverse.
Well, now the homosexual culture in San Francisco, or society. I kind of hate to use the term culture. I'm not sure I'm using it correctly. But the San Francisco society, homosexual society, has altered rapidly. And you've expressed this in Cities on a Hill. AIDS has changed it. And you describe the main street as having some of the gay bars that were there 10 years ago. But other people have moved into the neighborhood. There are different boutiques and restaurants and this sort of thing. We talk about the fact that these cultures are ephemeral. Certainly there's been a major change in homosexual life, hasn't there? Even in the period that you began working on.
Oh, very, certainly. I mean, that's what I think happens to small and coherent communities, that often they go through very dramatic periods of change. Sometimes, I mean, if they have a leader, a religious leader, the personality of the leader is terribly important to their eventual success or failure. In the case of the Castro, the great drama has been, and the great tragedy has been AIDS. And obviously this is something that affects not just the Castro, but gay men throughout the country. And again, this is only a concentrated example of what goes on in other homosexual communities.
When you began work on the Castro, was it difficult for you to gain entry into that world as a writer?
No, not at all. I think, I mean, the great spirit of gay liberation is openness. And, you know, coming out of the closet was the first commandment, as it were. And so I think they were happy to see a journalist, especially one from a magazine like The New Yorker, who was interested and would really take some pains and some effort to see what was going on.
And how about Lynchburg?
The same was
true. They welcomed you with open arms?
Yeah, well, I think on one hand, Americans love to be interviewed. I don't know this is so much true in any other country. But the other thing is when you're talking about community communities with ideals and with purposes and goals, they're the ones that particularly want to get their message out, and journalists are the best means.
Well, you certainly handled things dispassionately. I guess that's the best way, dispassionately. Were you seething, however, inside to say something directly about what you actually felt about these various cultures?
I think that I say all that I wanted to say about them in this book.
Tell me about Jerry Falwell. What kind of person is he? What kind of people are his followers?
Falwell grew up in a very poor part of town. I mean, it was right on the edges of town. They had a small family farm that didn't produce very much. His father died of cirrhosis of the liver. He was a drunk most of his life. And in this part of town, very few people had any hope for the future, any hope of getting out. Falwell always knew he had a destiny. He has a twin brother who he's sort of the opposite of Falwell. He didn't do too well in school. He loved to go out in the woods and so on. Falwell's very bright, and he was the captain of the football team, a big prankster, a risk-taker physically, a leader always, even when he was a kid. And he was in engineering school and bound to be an engineer when he converted, and soon thereafter decided to found his own church. I think he comes across to his followers as a sort of father figure. There are other preachers, of course, that have different personas, but I think he seems very reassuring to them. At the same time, he's very feisty, as we know, And I think that, you know, a part of fundamentalist culture always has been this sort of we-they relationship, that outsiders are sinful and bad, and only we are saved.
Is that what you meant when you wrote that Falwell has to fabricate enemies?
He often, I think, exaggerates them, because, I mean, he himself gets along with outsiders very well when he meets them in public. I mean, I remember seeing him on television interview with Bob Guccione, and they just were having a jolly time together. But when he talks to his own people about Penthouse or whatever it is outside, it's ferocious and terrifying. You know, if you see some of his films that he's done about everything from sort of crime in the streets to abortion and so on, they are so bloody that you can't watch them.
Do you join liberals who are wringing their hands over the moral majority in Jerry Falwell, or is your position one that this is essentially a benign movement?
Well, what Falwell has done is to empower the last part of white American society that really had no power, and that was these people who were living in poverty in the South and who came into the cities as a result of the industrialization and the New South and so on. He brought them from a point of the traditional fundamentalist doctrine is that of separation and withdrawal from the world. He's headed them straight into the middle of the world through politics, but also through building universities and having terrific ambitions for them. And I think this is what they wanted as well as he did. That's why he's so successful with them. He's the price to others may seem unacceptably high, but in terms of these people, I think that he has made great strides. And along the way, although it may not be visible from the point of view of an outsider, he has moderated and compromised a good deal.
Do liberals have anything to worry about?
Well, sure, liberals do, because there is still a notion that only Christians are the saved, that this country is what Falwell calls the last launching pad for world evangelism, he's had a good deal of influence on American foreign policy. He sees only military might as being important to foreign policy, nothing else very much. He would like to write many of his moral strictures into the law, the state law and the federal law. Clearly those who don't agree with him on many subjects have to worry about that.
Well, it's certainly a disturbing trend were religious people to apply their views to our politics. We can see what religion has done in the Middle East and in Ireland, and, India and Pakistan. It's frightening. You went to Florida to talk to the elderly in some city center. Why do the elderly insist on ghettoizing themselves?
Well, I don't think they think of it in that fashion. People who went to Sun City did so because I think, again, they didn't have very long or strong roots in their home communities. They were looking for a sunny place, a place where they could play golf, a pleasant place that was crime-free and so on. And they were looking, I think, most particularly for their peers, not just in terms of age, although that was important, but in terms of their backgrounds. They wanted to be around people like themselves. And they see this in a positive fashion.
It would seem to me, though, that some elderly, that elderly would find it more beneficial to be around a variety of people, just as they were as they grew up in their young adult years and in their middle age years. Instead, everybody, they turn around and everybody around them is the same age. I mean, it just seems to me that they've limited themselves by doing that.
Well, I asked a lot of people in that community why it was that they chose to go into an age-segregated community, and they looked at me in horror and askance. They said, look, there are many, many ages in this community, and clearly there were. People go there when they're 60
till
they're 90, 92. And somehow they had lost sort of consciousness of people below that ridge. I mean, if you asked the next question, they would talk about children, but they wouldn't think about people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know.
The Rajneesh, was that a con?
You know, whatever was going on in the mind of the guru Rajneesh, and nobody will ever know that, he provided a true religious experience for his devotees, and they really got something out of it. Now, you may say he got off with all this money, and furthermore, all these crimes were committed, and so on. But it's very interesting how people reassimilate that kind of thing into the structure of their faith. Jerry Falwell, for example, was had up by the SEC for improper bookkeeping for some time. Everyone around there thought, well, he's done for. Not at all. He managed to make this into an obstacle that the community had overcome successfully, right? All right. The same thing, Rajneeshpuram self-destructs. And the people who came out of it, some of them drift off, but others say the guru wanted us to have this experience. He wanted us to know what it was like to live in a community that was turning fascist. And, I mean, masters have Zen sticks to wake you up and to show you what life is really about.
Were the four reports in this book, were they all originally in The New Yorker?
Yes, they were, yes.
Well, after finishing your examination of these lifestyles or cultures or whatever you want to call them, I'm rather uncomfortable with the word culture. Can I find a better word?
I was looking for one. I hate the word lifestyle myself. I cannot do it. And I usually use the word community about each one of them, because they truly are, in the real sense of the word, a group of people living in one place under one sort of set of institutions. But the reason I use the word culture is that each is different from each other in almost an anthropological sense. I mean, if you talk about family structures and rites and rituals and so on, they are developing something which is more than a lifestyle.
Well, my last question, because I know you have that flight to catch after your examination of these communities, lifestyles, cultures. Maybe you touched upon this when we first began to talk, but I'd like for you to perhaps tell me again your conclusions. What conclusions did you draw after your study of these groups?
Well, by reading some 19th century history about the period of the Great Awakening, I began to see that this is often how Americans react to economic and social change, that there is a period of real social destabilization, and the young are kind of set loose, set free of their traditional roles and so on, and they join together in great bands. And out of those bands comes all kinds of social experiments. I think we're a country of visionaries and not one of philosophers so much. We tend to think all kinds of things and carry some of them out. And the fact that we do this means that we often, in starting all over again, we often forget our history, forget the past. That's the sort of weakness of it there, but in fact, and ironically perhaps, we're merely repeating it.
Social experimentation, that is really something that can be associated with a free country, isn't it? I can't see too much social experimentation in like closed countries such as China or Soviet Union.
Well, you might argue that China is going through great social experiments, but it's from the top down, and ours are always from the bottom up. But it doesn't happen, I mean, in other democracies, such as England, France, Germany, and so on. It did during the Industrial Revolution, but it really hasn't since then. I mean, the Americans seem to be the only ones who are carrying this kind of thing on at the moment.
Francis Fitzgerald, thank you very much.
Thank you.